May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Eric Harrington, and I'm here on behalf of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The District Court in this case erred in concluding that no reasonable juror could conclude that John Shepard was disabled under the ADA because the EEOC presented sufficient evidence that Mr. Shepard was unable or limited in his ability to perform personal care tasks between March to September 2003. The EEOC presented evidence that Mr. Shepard experienced a chronic, permanent impairment, that substantially limited his ability to care for himself. The evidence in the record shows that on 4 to 5 days a week, Mr. Shepard was unable to bathe himself without assistance. His wife had to wash his hair and wash his back and wash his feet. That he was unable to brush his teeth any day of the week because the motion of brushing his teeth caused his back to tighten. That his wife had to assist him 4 to 5 days a week in getting dressed. That he was unable to tie his shoes, that he had to wear slip-on shoes every day of the week. That he was unable to perform other tasks all the time that we perform in our daily lives. He was unable to do laundry. He was unable to do yard work. He was unable to cook for himself.
This is this six-month period we're talking about?
Yeah, this is all March to September 2003.
Well, how could he do anything else?
Well, his back was tight and he needed assistance. I think the record here, if you think through Mr. Shepard and you think through his day, was he could do many of these things with pain, or he was unable, or the pain was too much that he would require assistance. So you have a man who is sort of toughing it out to get through his days when he was having a flare-up, flare-ups that were usually caused by AutoZone's refusal to accommodate him. So if you think through Mr. Shepard's day, when he gets up in the morning, he needs all of this help, or he's sort of forcing it through, and you compare that to what an average person in the general population can do, we submit that a reasonable juror could conclude that he was substantially limited in the major life activity of caring for himself.
Well, my reaction to that is he can't even go to work.
AutoZone, not only could he go to work, he was going to work. He had one period in April 2003 where he was on medical leave. But this job was a job where he stood most of the day, and he reported that he never had trouble standing, or he moved around the store. And people would come in and need assistance in purchasing auto parts, and he would assist them. Most of this job was a customer service job. He wasn't performing Olympic tasks in doing this.
Sometimes you have to put a battery in a car, or you got to carry a case of oil, or you do something. I don't know what you do at AutoZone.
And he could carry some of the things, or he would get assistance from others. But this is what's important about this, is the only issue before this court is whether he was substantially limited in the major life activity of caring for himself.
I asked that question just because I'm confused at all those things he can't do at home.
Right. AutoZone has never argued on this March to September 2003 accommodation claim that he couldn't perform the essential functions of the job.
Yeah, they sort of disagree with that. Go ahead.
They agree with it. They agree that he can perform the essential function of the job between March to September 2003. He was, in fact, performing the essential functions of the job between March and 2003.
The point is that undermines his claim of a substantial impairment, that this condition substantially impaired his daily activities. If he's able to perform the tasks that his job required, which included stocking shelves and, you know, cleaning and mopping floors and, you know, the rest of it at AutoZone. So if he was capable of doing all those things, it undermines the claim that his ability to care for himself was substantially impaired.
Not at all. This is on summary judgment. You take the facts, and this court takes the facts in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
Mr. Harrington, I understand your position to be that, in essence, that's the essence of what the ADA does. Namely, it takes folks who have got substantial impairments but who are still able, at least with reasonable accommodation, to do their jobs. And those are the folks who are protected. Is that right?
Absolutely right, Your Honor. And in fact, the notion that the fact that if he's substantially limited in performing his personal care tasks, that means he can't work, that's a catch-22 that, as Your Honor, as Judge Hamilton points out, the ADA is specifically designed to prevent. Employers aren't allowed to make assumptions about what people can do at work based on their personal care limitations. That would create an amazing catch-22. Every time a plaintiff would come to court and say, I am substantially limited in major life activity of caring for myself, here's how, and then the court turns around and says, well, that means you can't work. That's the catch-22 that's been rejected in countless cases, and that and is not before this court. The only question before this court is whether a reasonable juror, based on Mr. Shepard's limitations, could be substantially limited in the major life activity of caring for himself. The question of whether or not he's qualified to perform the essential functions of the job are not before this court.
No, I understand that, but we're dealing with that six-month period before the last accident brought about his inability to perform the job, essentially. The claim that actually went to the jury, the claim having to do with the fall incident that caused his absence from work and the time thereafter. And during that period, the evidence demonstrates intermittent flare-ups of the ongoing condition that he was struggling with.
The evidence shows, and the evidence taken in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, is that 4 or 5 days a week he needed assistance with all that list of personal care tests. Couldn't dress himself, he couldn't wash his feet, couldn't wash his hair. So they're now only left with 1 or 2 days, and even on those other days, he couldn't perform laundry, he couldn't do laundry, he couldn't cook for himself, he couldn't do lawn care. So there's the whole, you take the totality of these facts and the light most favorable to the non-moving party, and all of those facts, it's very important to point out, were already conceded by AutoZone. They concede that 4 or 5 days a week.
They were part of their statement of undisputed facts, correct?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
As well as a bunch of other facts. If I saw this correctly, there were something like 291 statements of undisputed material facts in the motion.
In AutoZone's motion, yes.
Right. And then,
I don't have the exact number, but
a lot of them actually contradicted each other.
Some of
For
them
example,
are.
For example, there's some tension between Mrs. Shepard's testimony and Mr. Shepard's testimony about exactly how often and exactly how early some of these problems developed, right?
A little bit. Mrs. Shepard testified, and I can point the court to the page 30 of her deposition. She testified that it was 4 to 5 days a week. And then at a later point in her deposition, she testified that it was 2 or 3 times. And then right after that, she says it's hard to sort of, in her memory, because this was a permanent impairment. And that's another issue. That's a secondary factor the court needs to consider that the court failed to consider altogether. So this is a permanent impairment. And so she did not recall exactly when it was the frequency during a given time period. But all the facts taken light most favorable to the EEOC is that it was 4 or 5 days a week.
So you're looking for to allow a fact finder to determine whether or not he had this impairment.
Absolutely. And that's in this case, this court can affirm only if it concludes that if you take all of Mr. Shepard's limitations, only if you conclude that no reasonable person could conclude that he was substantially limited in the major life activity of caring for himself. To the extent that reasonable people can disagree about whether he was substantially limited, we win. There should be reversal, and a jury should decide that fact question.
And then I guess the jury goes on to decide whether he could actually, given that impairment, to actually do this job, even with a reasonable accommodation.
If the question of whether he's capable of performing the essential function of the job is before the jury, then yes, that would be one of the things that the jury would have to conclude.
We don't need to get into what that reasonable accommodation might be or whatever, no mopping or no nothing.
Not at all. The only question before this court is, can a reasonable juror conclude that he's substantially limited in the major life activity? And you would have to conclude that no reasonable juror could conclude that to affirm. And I don't know what much more Mr. Shepard has to show. There aren't many personal care tasks left that he was either unable or had a significant limitation in his ability to perform.
So if a jury court, well, okay. So given those allegations and what we can see, that he can't do all of these things, then they could say that is a personal care, whatever, chronic impairment, something that exists, and then the case would have to go on for there, whether or not he can do any of those things, any things at work, given that impairment.
Right. To be a qualified individual with disability, he must be able to perform the essential function of the job, but that is not the issue that's before this court. They never argued that in their summary judgment motion. They can't now come to the Seventh Circuit and say, oh, by the way, he can't perform the essential functions of the job. And then just one more. This case is not cited in my I thought it might come up. It's not cited in our brief, but this court in Mobley, and it's 531 F3rd 539, said the fact that someone is working is sufficient to overcome summary judgment on the question of whether they're qualified to do the essential functions of the job. So the fact that he's working means you can't grant summary judgment on that anyway. It's not before this court, but just...
You
All that's left here that we have before the court is this failure to accommodate claim for that six-month period.
That's absolutely right, yes.
And you supplement the authority.
I can do a 28-J letter, yes, I'd be happy to. And if I may, I'd like to reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Spitzeri?
May it please the court, my name is Joseph Spitzeri. I represent the Appalee AutoZone. There is an important point that the EEOC is missing in their argument and their argument before the district court and their argument here. In Sutton versus United Airlines, the U.S. Supreme Court stated that when you're examining the question of disability, you examine it in the present tense, at the time that the employee suffered the so-called adverse employment action or the failure to accommodate. You don't look at whether they're potentially disabled or hypothetically disabled. So in this case, if you follow Sutton versus United Airlines, we're talking about a very finite period of time, March to September 12th of 2003. And when the EEOC says that Susan Shepherd testified that Mr. Shepherd was unable to perform all these activities of daily living 4 to 5 times a week, that was before 2003. That was not from March to September 12th of 2003.
It was after 2003.
Well, it's both. It's before 2003, and then it's after 2003. And I, as Your Honor noted in the statements of fact, John and Susan Shepherd don't always agree.
Well, that's a bit of a problem that troubles me, Mr. Spitzeri, but it troubles me because of the way your brief treats that.
Okay.
Because your statement of the facts for these purposes goes through, in essence, the Susan Shepherd testimony, and the district court appears to have accepted that version of things. But in your statement of material undisputed facts, specifically in paragraphs 43 through 46 and 63, and 75, 76, 77, 78, 79, and 80, it all talks about those impairments at the time we're talking about here, while Mr. Shepherd was still working for AutoZone. And you've ignored all that evidence in your briefs.
I don't have those particular statements of fact before me, but I can comment on them.
You want me to talk about them?
No,
you want me to read them to you?
No, I can comment on them.
Okay.
Because I think I know what you're talking about. But there are – I did cite to some of John Shepherd's testimony in which Mr. Shepherd testified that his neck and back condition varied from improving to staying the same and worsening. And that's at 786 of the record. On the day of the incident, when he was wringing out a mop, September 13, 2003, he was fine with no pain at all. And that's 826 of the record.
Yeah, those are the facts that are good for you. But I'm talking here. Let me just read through these to you, okay? This is 63. There were times when Shepherd worked at AutoZone when Susan would have to assist him with showering activities.
Right.
75.
Can I respond to each one or no?
Because let me just go through them because I think they have a cumulative effect. Even while he was working at AutoZone, Shepherd had flare-ups that would require more of her assistance with his physical activities. That's 75.
Mm-hmm.
76, he would have these flare-ups approximately 4 to 5 times a week,
right,
during which he would not be able to put on his own pants, his own shoes, brush his hair, or brush his teeth. 77, then he was unable to sweep or vacuum around the house, do the laundry, do the dishes, rake leaves, shovel snow, or mow the lawn. 78, Shepherd would not be able to wash his own hair, back, or feet when having these flare-ups, again, 4 to 5 times a week while he's still working at AutoZone in the relevant time period. 79, Shepherd was experiencing these flare-ups 4 to 5 times a week before he went on leave of absence from AutoZone. And then if we treat all those facts as undisputed, as you proposed to district court, it sounds like he needed assistance with the most basic personal care on an almost daily basis during that relevant six-month period.
I would have to disagree that those statements of fact are related solely to the March to September of 2003 period of time.
They don't have to be solely linked to it. Are they related to it? Do they describe it? Can a reasonable jury find that they describe it?
No, because the restatements of fact were presented on a motion for summary judgment that was bifurcated in two time periods, the first one being March to September 12, 2003, and then September 13th of 2003 forward, when most of these incidents
Everything, I'm aware of what you're saying, but everything I just read to you was about his time before September of 2003 while he was still working for AutoZone.
Some of those predated March of 2003. I believe at least Susan Seppert's testimony, where she said it was prior to 2003. I don't believe that those statements relate to the March to September 12, 2003
time
period.
You wrote them.
I know that, but I'm saying I don't agree that that's what they say, that that's March to September of 2003, because I don't recall that.
4 to 5 times a week before he went on leave of absence from AutoZone.
Right. Well, that's
what other time could she be talking about?
Susan Shepherd
could you be talking about?
Susan Shepherd testified before 2003. 4 to 5 times a week before 2003. That's my point under Sutton versus United Airlines, that you have to look at the time period. And that specific fact is Susan Shepherd's testimony, and she testified, as the EEOC said in their reply brief, prior to 2003, he was impaired 4 to 5 times a week. That's what they say. And that's what I said, same thing.
Is the testimony
fairly... I can find a note in the reply brief, but they listed some facts in the reply brief that supported their claim, and one of them was Susan Shepherd's testimony that she needed to provide him assistance 4 to 5 times a week prior to 2003.
I think
that's
the appropriate
say,
question, though, is
sure.
whether that testimony is fairly susceptible of an interpretation that those symptoms continued through 2003. The onset may have been before 2003, and they may have been aggravated to the point that he required a leave after the accident in September of 2003. But the question is, does their testimony, Mr. and Mrs. Shepherd's testimony,
no, I don't think
she
could.
That those symptoms and the need for assistance persisted during the 6-month operative time period for this particular claim.
No, I don't think you can make that assumption because he has intermittent. It's an intermittent problem.
This is your paragraph 37.
Okay.
Shepherd has needed assistance with dressing himself, brushing his hair, and bathing on a daily basis from approximately the year 2003 or 2004 to the present time. Now, you put that in.
Right.
Is it unfair to read that as applying to the 6-month period in 2003?
Yes, because I think if you look at the testimony in detail, it's September 13, 2003 through 2004. Maybe the statement is inartfully drafted, but
I'll
that is the case.
I mean, the EEOC is entitled to take your statements the way you draft them if they like them, right?
Oh, absolutely, but they didn't. I believe they contested almost everything that didn't fit their case. But here's the other point.
That fits their case pretty well.
Well, on one aspect of it.
Let me check. Let's see what they said about 37. And 37 is undisputed.
Okay. Well, it only relates to let me talk a moment about Toyota Manufacturing versus Williams, because they took the Bragdon versus Abbott. You know, Bragdon versus Abbott established a 3-part test for determining disability. The only issue before this court is the third part of that test, which is whether the employee was substantially impaired in a major life activity that he's claiming. In Toyota Manufacturing versus Williams, the court said when you're looking at that issue of impairment, you look at the nature and severity of the impairment, the duration of the impairment, and the long-term impact resulting from the impairment. And I suggest to you that all of the testimony, or substantially all of the testimony that was submitted to the district court, dealt with one of those elements, the frequency of the impairment. There's very little, if any, testimony regarding the duration of the impairment, whether it was on a daily basis, 5 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. As Your Honor noted, he did go to work every day during that time period. So how long is the duration of the impairment? The evidence is silent on that. That's part of the prima facie case. What are the long-term impacts resulting from the impairment? The record is silent on that. That's another element of the prima facie case. There's no medical testimony whatsoever regarding his inability to perform major-like activity of caring for himself. There's some relating to work, and there's some relating to the sexual reproduction claim, which is dropped. And as this court noted, it's not an absolute requirement to have medical testimony. There are certainly cases where the disability and the impairment are so clear that medical testimony is not required. But as this court noted in Fredrickson versus UPS, there the court did state that there was no medical evidence to corroborate the self-assessment of the plaintiff. And in these cases, and I'm sure the court's well aware, a layman is not competent to give medical testimony.
What was the impairment in Fredrickson?
In Fredrickson, it was leukemia, and the issue was walking and breathing were the claims of impairment, the major life activity that they were being impaired in. And this court said the evidence was insufficient. There was no medical evidence to corroborate self-assessment. Vague assertions of difficulty performing a major life activity do not create a genuine issue of material fact. And Toyota Manufacturing versus Williams goes even further and says the terms of the ADA must be interpreted strictly to create a demanding standard for qualifying as disabled. And I interpret that, and AutoZone interpret that, as you must meet each and every requirement of disability, not just frequency. And that would be the point that I would make. Also, I guess...
Your time has expired.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Harrington, your time has also expired, but I will give you a quick minute to rebut.
Great. Let me just, in addition to what they have already conceded, let me just read to the court from Susan Shepherd's deposition. She was asked... what time period they were talking about. So here's the question. Okay, now even before he stopped working, this is on page 30 of her deposition. Now even before he stopped working for AutoZone, during the time when he was having a flare, did he require more of your assistance then? Yes, was the answer. And were there times when you would have multiple flare-ups in a week? Yes. And how bad could it get in terms of the frequency of the flare-ups? At least 4 or 5 times a week. That's Mrs. Shepherd. Prior to 2000, his question was, did it during the times when he was still working at AutoZone? And then Mr. Shepherd is crystal clear about the time period as well. Question, okay, and that would put us around the 2003-2004 area, so let me ask just so we're clear. Was your wife helping you on a daily basis get dressed, brush your hair, bathe while you were working at AutoZone prior to September 13, 2003? Yes and no, he says. Okay, explain that. Not every day. On a weekly basis, how frequent would she have to help you? I would probably say maybe 4 or 5 days, maybe. Now he says...
What page is that? I'm sorry,
Your Honor, that's on page 170 and 171 of his deposition. Now AutoZone says, well, that was before 2003. What that really meant was 1996 to January 1st, 2003, and he was miraculously better during 2003. The record's clear, and we ask that this court reverse the district court and remand for a trial on the accommodation claim.
All right. Thank you.
Your Honors.
Our thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.